If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Okay, folks, you are once again listening to Life on Planet Porky. It's Planet Porky, the podcast, and I am delighted to say that once again I'm joined by the delectable Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann, welcome again.
Here I am.
Great to see you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Touching my hand there because it makes me feel better on this particularly hot day. Okay, folks, I want to tell you about The Economist, okay? The Economist, the internationally famous magazine, is about far more than just economics and finance. Of course, it's there at the heart of business, and it covers a range of subjects from world politics and business to science, technology, art and the environment. But in every copy of The Economist are those individual features which light it up and which make it sing. The words leap off the page when you're looking at the theatre reviews, at the book reviews, and what those brainy people at The Economist think about television, OK? It helps readers prepare for what's going on in the world around them. The Economist sifts through the noise, focusing on the essential information that tells the real story. And let's face it, in these troubled times, we need to know what is going on. It has been a trusted source of intelligence for over 170 years. And the kind of person who reads The Economist is that person who never stops asking the questions, probing, and wants to know why the world is the way it is, OK? In fact, in this week's edition, the election speculation is mounting, and the politicos who write for The Economist are interpreting the very latest development. Now, the idea here, folks, is to give you a free print copy of The Economist, OK? So for your free print copy of The Economist, just text PLANET, that's P-L-A-N-E-T, to 78070, OK? Let me repeat that, please. For your free print copy of The Economist, just text PLANET to 78070.
Now, I tell you what, we got a lot of feedback from the last podcast, and we ended the last podcast talking about a very good friend of yours in the rock and roll world, Steve Harley.
Ah, the Cockney Rebel.
Cockney Rebel, absolutely. And people have sent me a few messages saying, Mike, don't you have a story about Steve Harley? Well, I've got a little story about Steve Harley, but it's not the same as yours because you knew him. But on the very first day I started in journalism, it was at the Newcastle Editorial Training Centre, Thompson Regional Newspapers, and just met everybody. And then I was put together with two other blokes, and we were put together in a little flat in Wall's End on the north bank of the Tyne. And so we got the train back, got off, and there was a pub at the end of the road called the Northumberland Arms, and everybody had come with us because nobody had been really allocated proper digs then. And we were in this pub, and it was quite quiet. It only just opened just after 5:30. Pubs only opened at 5:30 in those days. So I said, look, I'll get the drinks in. Somebody go and put some music on the jukebox. And the first record that was played was Steve Harley, Cockney Rebel, Come and Meet Me, Make Me Smile. And I thought, I'll have to remember this forever. It's the first song I've ever heard after becoming a journalist. But of course, you know Steve Harley personally, don't you?
Well, I do. And the interesting thing there's a connection because right. Steve became a journalist on an East End newspaper because of my father. So the Daily Mirror used to drop through the letterbox every day.
Yes.
And there on the back pages,
covering Ken Jones now.
Football and boxing and so on, was my dad. And Steve was inspired by my dad years and years before he met me.
Was he a football fan?
Yes, he was. Yeah. And so he went into journalism. Oh. And you know he had polio when he was a kid.
Yes, so, absolutely.
So obviously couldn't play football, so writing about football was the next best thing.
Wow.
But yeah. So,
and how did you get to meet him?
So I was sent to interview him. He got involved with the Phantom of the Opera.
Oh, yeah.
Andrew Lloyd Webber's musical. And he recorded the title song with Sarah Brightman. the Phantom of the Opera is here.
Yes.
And that...
The Phantom of the Opera
is here. Yeah, we shouldn't sing, you know.
No, we should. I like it. I like singing. It's good. People actually appreciate my voice.
But
anyway,
then,
please
but then,
go on.
No. Yeah. But then he wasn't chosen to play the Phantom because they went in the end for Michael Crawford, who none of us could get.
Sorry, was he an actor, though?
Look, anyone's an actor.
Yes, you know, I agree.
Given the right training, and given the right guidance, everyone is an actor.
Kylie Minogue.
You know, exactly.
Yes,
I rest your case.
Yes.
But he should have got that part because he was brilliant. He was sinister.
Yeah.
He's quite dark, Steve. You know, he's quite gothic.
Yes, yes.
And I think none of us could see Michael Crawford in that role because of Some Mothers Do Have 'Em on the telly, where he was always hanging off the end of a bus,
a runaway bus by a dog lead
or something.
Sure, yeah.
He was too funny.
Yeah.
And we couldn't really see him in that serious role.
Yeah.
But, of course, he went on to be incredibly successful.
Oh, he did, well, very
Michael
successful.
Crawford in that part.
And then didn't after that he do Barnabas or something? Who was the, you know, the one about the circus?
Barnum.
Barnum, that's right, Barnum. Yeah, yeah. He was always like, oh, that's really interesting.
There were more strings to his bow,
yeah.
So we wrote him off too soon.
And a few years later, right, I got invited into a box at Spurs, which your uncle played for, of course, with great distinction, didn't
he? Uncle Cliff Jones.
Still there. I read a piece about him a few weeks ago. He can still get to the same pair of trousers he had 40 years ago.
You should see him. He's in his 80s.
Yeah.
He looks like a 12-year-old.
Yeah.
He has that much energy.
Yeah,
absolutely. He's astonishing.
Absolutely. I got invited into the box, and the bloke who owned the box was he dealt in a particular form of insurance. I think it's called reinsurance. They take on extra special risks and all this kind of stuff on things like, you know, oil tankers that have been in the news lately and all that kind of stuff. And he owned a horse, which he called Cockney Rebel. And your mate went and stood with the horse when it won its first great race. And the picture is of him there now, Steve Harley with the horse.
What a man.
And yeah, and it's fantastic. But anyway, look, that's Steve Harley. Now, talking about young people, and you've got a son, haven't you?
I do.
Of this sort of age. Let me read this to you. Student Tom Warburton, as in the bread, I like Warburton's bread, age 20, of Bedford, aims to be the youngest person to do a solo trek to the South Pole in November. What would you say if your son at that age came to you and said, oh, hi, Mum, I'm going to sort of give, you know, the career possibilities a swerve. I've decided I'm going to take a trek down to Antarctica. What would your reaction be?
Get a job.
Exactly.
You know, get out of bed, get a job. We know where the South Pole is.
Yeah.
There's only so much ice and snow you can photograph.
There's been a lot of people going there already.
Come on, you know,
yeah.
Shackleton went there. They've got the boat in Dulwich College.
Yes.
Where my son went, by the way. So he knows about
the
South.
Oh, right, okay, yeah.
I don't think it's relevant anymore, is it?
No.
You know, it's a midlife crisis thing, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, go and risk your life because you've had the most of it. And you've got the money to pay for it.
Yes.
This is the rub. This guy is going to be crowdfunding, I betcha.
Online
to try and get other people to pay for his jolly.
Yes.
Sorry, not impressed.
No, I totally agree. And the other thing is that if he gets into trouble, hundreds of thousands of pounds will have to be spent by rescue services to get him out of trouble.
Oh, he'd get eaten by a polar bear. It'll be all right.
Polar bears actually are only in the Arctic.
Oh, well, there you go. Shows how much I know.
No, in the Antarctic, you have penguins, but lots of them, and mad seals.
Death by penguin.
Yeah, they're death by penguin.
That's a Batman scenario, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it could be. What I object to about this is he's 20, right? So he's either come out of university without completing his course.
Well, he hasn't come out unless he's dropped out.
That's what I mean.
Yeah.
He's either dropped out of university or he hasn't been to university, in which case he should have a job, because people at that age, if they think, oh, I'm going to make myself famous walking to the South Pole, why don't you make yourself credible and get a fucking job? Because while you're walking to the South Pole, mate, a lot of your friends are actually getting jobs and working and will be a lot further up the old greasy pole of life before you get out there.
That is not contributing to the economy or to the world.
No. In any way.
Get a job.
In any way. I totally agree. Now then, I wanted to talk to you, Leslie Ann, because you're a woman of the world, about a place called, about a community actually, called the Bruderhof. Bruderhof women live in Sussex.
Oh, this is the Robertsbridge.
I think you know something about it.
Yeah, it's Robertsbridge. It's, not far from that border of East Sussex, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's a kind of Amish community.
It's like the Amish in America. The Amish were made famous in which film?
Was it
called The Amish?
May have been.
Yeah, I think it was called The Amish. It involved the guy who was also, what's his name? You know, the guy with the whip, you know?
you know, the guy in the...
I've known a few guys with whips.
Really? Well, you don't know about this. It's a family show. The anthropological explorer, you know, what's his name? Not Crocodile Dundee, not... you know the guy I'm talking about.
I was going to say Desmond Morris, but that's showing our age, isn't it?
In the 80s, it was all the rage, and my mind's gone. I'm talking now, and our listeners now will be screaming at their podcast
David Bellamy, I don't know.
No, the actor, he's very famous. He crashes his plane in California.
He's so famous that we... Yeah. Oh, I know, yeah. Indiana Jones. Harrison Ford.
Thank you, He didn't he star in a film called The Amish?
Probably he did, yeah. Yeah.
And he made the mortal sin of falling in love and Rogerizing an Amish woman, didn't he?
For real?
No, in the film.
In the film.
In the film, yeah. Yeah, that's not allowed.
I mean, now, they surrender their identity.
Yeah.
They don't use money. They have to conform to not adorning their bodies, faces and hair with any kind of cosmetics or anything like that.
I think it's awful. I think they're prisoners. Because I'm looking at a picture of
psychological prisoners, really, aren't they?
And they look very plain. Yeah. They look as though they have no intention whatsoever of making themselves look more attractive. But it says here, because I'm reading a review of it in one of my journals, there's a touch of The Handmaid's Tale about the Bruderhof community. Have you watched The Handmaid's Tale?
Well, I haven't, but
I don't know. I think it's awful.
I think it's about surrendering one's thought process.
Yeah.
It's not thinking for yourself anymore. Some people just get sick of life, don't they? And they don't want to have to make decisions anymore. So I can see why it would appeal
to a
certain...
Yeah, but to bring up a child in that community
is
fucking evil.
That is wrong.
Because you're not giving the child a chance to think for themselves and get on with their own lives. Okay?
So they can do this if they like.
I think it's disgraceful.
But they shouldn't have children.
It says here, most people have never heard of the Bruderhof. Well, that's true. Unsurprising, so there are just 3,000 members of the small Christian sect in the world. And they're spread across the UK, the US, Germany, Australia and Paraguay. In the UK, there are Bruderhof settlements in Nonnington, don't know where that is, Kent and Peckham, South London.
That's just down the road from me. I haven't seen any. Mind you, they're not allowed out, are they? You're not going to see them in the pub, right?
No. Well, I think it's absolutely disgraceful that you make people behave like that and conform and regulate, because the Amish is all about not coming into the real world, not coming into the modern world. Who does that remind you of? It reminds me of that...
Travellers, gypsies, who make their communities on other people's property. But not wanting to pay tax, but expecting to go into hospitals and avail themselves of the services that we all pay for.
Well, that is one point of view, certainly, and there is a great discussion to be had there. But I was thinking rather more of these... what are they called? The guys who put boats on the middle of Oxford Street? Extra something?
What are they called?
Climate change protesters.
Warriors. Whatever they're called.
EX or
we so
XT
don't care about them that we can't think what they're called.
But what I'm saying is they want to take the world back to no growth and to no fossil fuels. That would be going back to Amish days, because the Amish drive around in horse-driven wagons, and their only concession after one of them was killed after running into another, is that they will now allow indicators on their horse-drawn wagons. But they will not allow fuel-based engines, electric engines, or anything else.
Well, you know, they blocked a road the other day. This was a scandal, and prevented a guy getting down a motorway to say goodbye to his dying father.
Absolutely.
Crocodile tears.
Crocodile tears from the particular protester who said, we're very sorry, but of course, in the end, it'll be worth it. Terribly heartless thing to do. Now, I tell you what I want to talk to you about, Leslie, and you're a woman of very exotic tastes, okay? And that's because you have interviewed the rich and the famous and the glamorous people. You've been to many glamorous places, including, of course, the south of France, and including maybe Paris. Do you like Paris?
I love Paris. I lived in Paris for a year when I was student. Yeah,
really?
Because we were doing...
Did you go to the Sorbonne?
No, I went to the Alliance Française.
Alliance
which
Française?
Which is the sort of poor man's Sorbonne, if you like.
Oh, is it? And do you speak fluent French?
I did. I mean, it's rusty, but I can go back and it'll come back within a couple of days.
Yeah.
I did actually love it, and I felt very soigné when I was living there.
What's that mean?
Sort of sophisticated.
Sophisticated,
As you say, a woman of the world.
Yeah.
I was only 20.
Well, it doesn't matter.
I was kidding myself.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. You were clearly very popular, even in those circles. Now, I think Paris is a brilliant city. When I was there, I was covering, believe it or not, the Rugby World Cup. And where I was staying, where the studio was from the Gare du Nord down to the Eiffel Tower. So I used to walk, you know, down to the Seine and along the left bank and cross the river and all that kind of stuff. Beautiful walk.
It is. And Paris is very compact, unlike London, which sprawls.
That's right.
You know, so you pretty much can walk everywhere.
Yes, yes, you can. Also, fantastic architecture. The buildings are beautiful. And
They collaborated, didn't they, during the war?
Well, you see, I feel a bit sorry for them, because if we'd been landlocked to continent, we'd have been overtaken by Germany as well.
Yeah, I expect we
because
would.
We had the English Channel, we were quite lucky. But anyway, look, I want to draw your attention to this particular story. This is, as always, the actress Clotilde Courau. Right, that's her name.
That's a good accent, actually.
Clotilde Courau. I've never heard of her, but she is often described as France's, you know, fairy tale princess and all that. She married a guy called Prince Emmanuel Filiberto, the grandson of the last Italian king. I didn't know there was a last Italian king, okay? And they shack up together in Paris, okay? Now, what happens is she goes out on the train from their house.
Hang on. They've got all this money and she goes on the train.
She goes on the train.
Nuh-uh. Where's the chauffeur? The chauffeur's in on it.
Do you know what? In London, sometimes in the winter, I would use the tube rather than the train because all major cities are now so bunged up
gridlocked by
all these climate protesters who demand that we have pedal bike lanes, bus lanes, all sorts of lanes all over the place, but no road for cars, okay? So anyway, she goes out. She gets on the, is it the metro in Paris?
Le métro.
Le métro. And somebody nicks her bag. The fact that the house keys are in a bag seems to have escaped her. She didn't even bother reporting it. And later that day, when on holiday, she was amazed when she got back to find that her house had been burgled and between 200,000 and 500,000 euros worth of jewellery had been stolen, OK? And she didn't even bother reporting to the police and didn't change the locks.
No. I smell a rat. This is an insurance job.
You think so?
Got to be, yeah. I mean, she's not that stupid, is she? She's savvy enough to land herself this descendant of the last Italian king.
Yeah.
She's got all this jewellery.
Yeah.
She's a rich, clever lady. She's an actress. She's been around. She knows about the world.
Well.
You know, come on.
Yeah.
Come on.
Well,
sorry.
Well.
I was born yesterday.
Yeah, I found it very odd. My niece once stayed with me in London. My niece is a real go-getter, and she got a degree in business studies and then went to work for Thompson Holidays in St Albans and thought, this is not for me, wanted something better. So she applied for and got onto a course to become a chartered surveyor in London. So she came and lived with me. I was very happy for a year to have my niece there. You know, I felt I was doing my bit for the family and all that kind of thing, because the family's from Bournemouth.
Satisfying your paternal urges.
Absolutely, yeah. So anyway, she rings me up one Friday evening about 8 o'clock. You know, oh, hello, Uncle Mike. You know, hello, darling. How are you? Name's Karen. She said, oh, I don't believe this. She said, I've just had my bag stolen. I said, you've had your bag stolen? I said, goodness gracious, how did that happen? And it was taken from under her seat. I think, in fact, she told me the bar she was in, quite a popular bar. I can't quite remember which one it was now. But I was in there recently and somebody reminded me it was there. Anyway, point of story is, I said, and she said, look, I've got no money, nothing. There weren't, we didn't have cards in those days, you know, where you could tap in, tap out and all that. And I was in a pub down near the Talk Towards Studios. I said, will you ever come down and see me and we'll go home together, you know. So she comes down and it was like nothing had happened, you know. She was all giggly and like, oh, isn't that terrible, you know, it's really strange, you know. Just happened one. I said, okay. I said, well, anyway, I said, have you got your keys? I assumed that she had her keys in her pocket of her coat. She said, oh, no, they're in my bag. I said, they're in your bag. Right. Was there anything else in your bag that would have had the address to the apartment on it? She said, oh, let me think. No, we wouldn't be anything except the keys. I said, well, the keys haven't got the address on it, have they? She said, oh, actually, they did, Uncle Mike. I said, what do you mean? She said, oh, well, I never took off the, you know, the label that was attached to them, which had your full address on it. I said, you're having me on. I had to order a car, right, and get home at breakneck speed because whoever nicked a bag had a set of keys with my home address on it in Stockbroker Belt, Surrey.
Classic.
Yeah.
Thoughtless kid.
Yeah. And fortunately, we got there, nothing. But I had the locks changed that night. I had to. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I'd have to put couches up against the door to make sure nobody got in.
They don't think.
And it cost 650 quid.
Of course it did. They don't think. Yeah. But they need to learn those kind of lessons. But yeah, that obviously was a genuine mistake on her part.
Yeah.
But I mean, we can all have our bags stolen. It doesn't make her dipsy.
Yes.
I had mine nicked in the Oak Room at the Plaza Hotel in New York.
Blimey, well.
You know that lovely place?
Yeah, I love it, yeah.
So you sit down at the table, tuck your bag behind you.
Yes.
I didn't even feel it go.
Good God, that's amazing.
The tape recorder of the interview I'd just done was in the bag. My
Good
passport,
God.
All my car, everything.
Did you get any of it back?
None of it.
Oh, terrible.
So I had to go and do the interview again. But more to the point, my passport was used. Somebody entered the UK on my passport, which is pretty scary.
Did they alter your picture or make themselves look like you?
No idea. I never saw it again.
Idea.
But I had to go to the consulate, as it is in New York, and get a document to
on
prove
Third
my
Avenue.
Identity.
That's right, yeah.
To be able to
British
return.
Information Services,
there
it's
you
called.
Are.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Oh, well, there we go.
Uh-huh.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Right, okay, folks, you are listening to Planet Porky, and this is the second half of today's podcast. I've got Leslie Ann Jones with me. We've just been talking about how stupid people can be, but also there's an awful lot of very bright people in the world, and some of those bright people, sometimes, we talked, didn't we, earlier on about people going down to the Antarctic and wasting their lives. What about somebody who walks up Ben Nevis? What do you think of that?
Well, you know, walk up Ben Nevis if you have to, but don't take your bananas. And don't sling the skins on the ground.
It's unbelievable. Tell us what you're talking about here, please, Leslie Ann.
So walkers who go up Ben Nevis are discarding their banana skins on the way instead of taking their rubbish home with them or whatever they do when they go walking, just dropping these on the ground.
How disgraceful is that?
I think
they don't even put them in a plastic bag and take them home with them.
Isn't
wankers?
The entire foundation of the mountain rotting away because of
this? Yes, it is. It is. All these banana skins are eating into the very fabric of the mountain. People are slipping on them. But worse than that, I understand from my investigations, it takes something like, you know, 20 years for a banana skin to, what do they call it? Like, you know, disappear. What's
decompose.
It called? Decompose.
So why is that? I mean, it is an organic thing, isn't it? It's the ultimate kind of self-packaged piece of fruit, isn't it, really?
Yeah. Yeah, listen to this. It's estimated that about 300 banana skins are discarded every week on the route up Ben Nevis. A litter pick over the 2 days this week by a member of the Real Three Peaks Challenge, they're the people who are a mountain cleanup campaign, collected 8 kilograms of banana skins. Now, 8 kilograms of banana skins is a lot of banana skins. Very lot of banana skins.
That's a pile, isn't it? I'm quite surprised that they don't self-digest or whatever the term for a banana skin is.
Yeah.
I'm quite surprised they take that long to break down.
Oh, they do. The popularity of Ben Nevis, like other parts of the Highlands, has increased sharply. The mountain has 160,000 visitors a year, up from 120,000 last year, and it's wearing away the mountain. Do you know this is happening all over the world? Do you know, have you been to Peru, to that place like Machu Picchu? Have you been there?
No.
Neither have I.
No, I want to, but there are a lot of bandits on the route.
Well, not only that, my niece went there and it takes hours to get up there now because you're queuing
behind
somebody
else. Slipped on all the banana skins.
Slipped on all the banana skins, you're absolutely right. She also said, by the way, it's so high that you can take five steps, and then you have to rest. Literally, and she's like, you know, a healthy, you know,
altitude,
young lady in her late 20s, okay?
We have to ban bananas, don't we?
It's happening in Iceland. Mm. In Iceland, too many tourists. And the latest one I heard is Amsterdam. Amsterdam are going to have to start regulating and barring tourists because it has now become so popular. The world's getting so wealthy, Leslie Ann, that people can travel at will now. Bargain breaks, Amsterdam,
anywhere
£87,
they want.
Go anywhere they want.
Chuck their McDonald packages in the
canals. Yes.
So they're having to dredge the canals constantly.
That's right.
Finding quite a lot of other stuff as
Some of these wankers, by the way, who leave banana skins on Ben Nevis, right, they are part of what's called the Three Peaks Challenge. So the reason they can't take time to collect their banana skins on Ben Nevis is they rush down there and then they go up Scarfell Pike, which is in
the Lake District.
Lake District, well done. It is, oh, right. And then they climbed Snowdon, which is near where
North
I grew up, in North Wales, near Bala Lake. And as a result of which, they're running round, leaving all these... Right, the real Three Peaks Challenge collects 230 kilograms of rubbish from Ben Nevis, 8 kilograms of which is banana skins. I mean, this is an utter disgrace. I just wish these people wouldn't do it, don't you?
So, well, Himalayas, look at that. I mean, it's disgusting the amount of rubbish that people leave in the foothills.
Have you seen a picture lately of people going up Everest?
Yeah.
It's like a bus queue, but it's a bus queue that goes 2 miles long. Some people are so stupid, and we've discussed this before on a Planet Porky podcast, they freeze to death at the top waiting to get to the summit. They literally freeze to death.
Yeah.
It's minus 25, and so they're, you know, supposed to clap their hands and stamp their feet and all that. And then older people just either fall off the mountain because they get frozen stiff, or they die of hypothermia.
That's what they get for dropping banana skins.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I've got no sympathy.
Good. Organic waste is biodegradable, but that does not mean it is acceptable to throw away, says Zero Waste Scotland. It can take 1,000 years for a plastic bag to degrade, 500 years for a bottle, and 80 years for a crisp packet, OK?
But they don't care about that because they're going to be dead by then and they don't mind about
the
planet that they are bequeathing to their kids.
Even cigarette butts take 12 years.
And that's kind of organic apart from the paper bit, isn't it?
Yeah, orange peel takes 2 years.
It's ridiculous. But the thing about bananas, you know, people tend to eat them, athletes and so on, because of the potassium content of the banana, which is a complete fallacy. You know that little black bit on the end of a banana that we all throw away because it's bitter? We don't eat that. All the potassium is in that bit.
Is it?
Yeah. So you can eat the banana. It's not really going to do you much good. A lot of sugar.
A banana plant, by the way, only flowers once.
Ever?
Ever. And then
I know how it feels.
Oh really? No, that's unkind. And then they come along with the machete. They cut off the crop of bananas, and that's it. That's dead. It'll never flower again. And so what they have to do is somebody has to follow them and uproot the banana tree and plant a new one.
Is this the world we created?
This is the world we created, definitely. And I know that because somebody told me in a banana plantation in somewhere like Sri Lanka. No, not Sri Lanka, sorry, in St. Lucia in the Caribbean. There'd be bananas in the Caribbean, wouldn't there? Yeah, lots of bananas in the Caribbean. Yeah, I quite like St. Lucia. I used to whiz around the island in a motorised canoe, and it was very acceptable.
In the days when going to the Caribbean was quite a thing, wasn't
it? Yeah, that's right, I agree.
I sort of feel ambivalent about that now, going to places where the local society, their lifestyle is so at odds with ours.
Well, one of the reasons why I'm quite happy to stay outside of Europe is because I like the mystery of going to foreign countries which have nothing to do with me and learning the culture and meeting the people. And
there
you know,
is no culture anymore, though. The whole world is Starbucks and McDonald's now, isn't it?
Well,
anywhere you go, as far as you want to go.
And, you know, enjoying the practices that they do and all that kind of stuff. Now, I have an issue to raise with you, Leslie.
Uh-huh.
And this came from a conversation we had before today's podcast when we were having a slight libation, a small libation, to stir our mental thought. You claim to me that you go to church every week. Is this right?
I'm a long-standing member of St. Bride's in Fleet Street, the journalist church.
Of course, beautiful
church. I've been a guildswoman there.
Last time I went there was for Jimmy Lawton's memorial service, a real old colleague of your father's.
And we had Hugh McElveny's memorial.
And I didn't go to Hugh's, actually.
Yeah, I know you didn't. I was on duty that day. But,
were you?
Yeah, that's been my church since 1985.
Mm. Right. But do you go every Sunday?
Obviously, I'm away sometimes, so I don't make it those.
But you travel
Sundays.
In from where you live
it's
in.
It's very quick, 15, 20 minute drive.
In South London,
Sunday.
Okay, well, that's very good. Okay, well, I admire that because I also like to go to church if I can. Down on the coast, there's a very nice little church in the village next to where I live, and I go there sometimes. Up in London, or Surrey, I should say, up in Surrey, there's also a very nice little church, actually, in a village there. But I don't find warmth in going to church occasionally. Do you understand what I mean?
Yeah.
I don't feel like, you know, you're a member of my flock. You know, people who follow me, the Portmeister, you know, Porky Parry, they're a member of my flock, and I embrace them, and I feel warm.
It's got to be regular input, hasn't it?
I always feel like a stranger going into churches that are where I'm not a regular worshipper. Now, the reason I'm asking you about this, right, is because a guy called Mark Montgomery, who is a rev, i.e. a reverend, right, and he's got a church in Kings Hill, which is near Maidstone in Kent, okay, he is now decided to launch a 4 o'clock on Sunday church service every week because He says that he's aware that lifestyles these days mean that people don't want to get up too early on a Sunday morning. He's insinuating that people go out and get bladdered every Saturday night, right? Can't be bothered to get out of bed, so give churchgoers the option of going at 4 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon.
Not going to happen. We have a regular evensong service.
Exactly.
Whether at 5 or 5:30.
Yeah.
Time varies. It's very poorly attended. The 11 o'clock service is pretty well attended most weeks.
Yep.
I think the main reason that people don't go to church on Sundays is because they have so much else to do.
Yes.
So you've got kids, they've got sport fixtures all over the place, especially when they've got away games. They've got swimming lessons to take them to.
Yes.
They've got gardens to attend to, or cleaning, or you know, cars to sort out, or whatever else. So it's not really about the time of day on a Sunday.
Yes.
It's that Sunday has become such an important day in domestic life.
Sure.
And we need our Sundays. And it takes up half your day going to church.
Loads of people these days, you're absolutely right. I mean, when I was a kid, we went to Sunday school. There was nothing else to do on a Sunday. No shops were open. Cinemas weren't open. There was nothing on.
We didn't do activities,
no,
did we?
No, activities. There was no football.
Go in the garden.
Yeah.
We used to hang around in the garden.
I would like Sunday to be quieter than it is. I wouldn't object to pubs being closed on a Sunday.
And Sunday roast. Always a Sunday roast.
As long as there were. Yeah,
grandparents around, cousins around, all of that.
That's right. As long as there was some sort of exclusive drinking bar I could go to on a Sunday, you know. But I don't think that the great masses should be allowed to go out to the pubs like a normal day.
I agree. I liked the ritual of old-fashioned Sundays.
Yes,
to church in the morning is part of that.
Yeah.
Coming home and having the big sit-down roast is part of that.
I want the streets to be quieter on a Sunday because I want to be able...
You want to pound the pavements, don't you?
Well, pound the pavements a bit, but also I want to get away from the pressures and the stresses of every other day and think it's Sunday. Now, before we go, Leslie Anna, thank you for joining me today and for the previous couple of podcasts.
It's been lovely, really has.
Joined with me. I am aware of the fact that you have a massive project underway at the moment, and it involves one of my heroes, John Lennon. Could you perhaps tell us a little bit about it without revealing too many secrets?
Astonishing though it seems, 2020, next year, will mark the 40th anniversary of John's assassination.
I know.
And he would have turned 80 in October 2020.
Amazing.
So I'm writing a book which marks both those incredible dates.
Yep.
So in 2020, the 40th and the 80th.
Yes.
And it's revisiting John's life and what he left as a legacy, musical legacy, in a time when most people still know Beatles music. My kids certainly do.
Yes.
They can sing you most lyrics to most Beatles songs.
Yes, exactly.
But they have no idea who he was. So my eldest daughter, who is 31, said to me quite recently, I'm not joking, tell me again, how did John Lennon die? And I said, oh, come on,
Mia.
Let me see. And then I thought, no, actually, she was born a decade after he died.
Mm.
So there is no reason why she would know.
No.
And similarly, my younger kids have no idea about the Liverpool years, the Hamburg years.
Yeah.
What is Hamburg was actually what I got in response to, do you know anything about the Beatles in Hamburg?
Mm.
So it felt like time to revisit the entire story and to re-deliver it to younger generations who know nothing and are not going to read those big old tomes written by rock journalists of yore.
Okay. And have you had to research this deeply? Because, of course, an awful lot's been written about John Lennon over the years.
Probably more about John than any other rock star you can think of.
Right,
so I went back to Liverpool and I went to his childhood home, Aunt Mimi's house.
Yeah, sure.
Stood in his bedroom, looked out of the window, down the street a little bit, at the corner where his mother was knocked down and killed by an off-duty policeman.
That's right.
And it felt really odd standing in that room.
Golly, yeah, I bet
And he's not there, you know. You're getting some sort of vibe, but he's not there. Where I felt John the most was at Strawberry Fields, the memorial in New York, opposite the Dakota building.
I was there just last year, and I nearly got arrested because I knelt down in front of the Dakota because I was saying to my mate, this is exactly where Chapman knelt down, said, excuse me, Mr. Lennon, and then shot him five times in the back.
Yeah, four bullets went in.
Four bullets went in. And I nearly got arrested because the cops were saying, what are you up to? And then, of course, we went across the road into Strawberry Fields. And that very poignant memorial, you're right, yeah.
It is, and Yoko said at the time, didn't she, there is no funeral for John. How can John Lennon have a funeral?
No, exactly.
Who would you invite? Who would you not invite?
It
was impossible, and David Bowie didn't have one for the same reason.
Is that right?
Yeah. But I think that memorial...
Well, they just both cremated and then... ashes were just...
There was talk that Bowie had some kind of Buddhist ritual, who knows? Yeah. I mean, I guess not with John, and I guess maybe his ashes were scattered somewhere that only she knows about.
Yeah, well, exactly, yeah.
Maybe even in Japan, because he was very fond of visiting Japan and his relatives there through her towards the end of his life.
Very odd indeed. Well, you've got one avid reader here, because I can't read enough about John Lennon. And as you quite rightly say, it had a terrible effect on my life. John Lennon was easily the favourite musician of my life. Every song he's written, I've liked. Every lyric he's written, I've felt I can interpret something in it. And every word he's said, like, for instance, his favourite quote for me was, "Life is something that happens when you're busy getting on with other things." Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I thought, you don't know how right you are. I just realised recently, right, that a lease on a property I own has just dipped below the magic 87-year mark. You know, that's when you've got to start thinking about buying the leasehold and all that kind of stuff. And I've known that for 10 years. But, you know, I've been getting on with other things.
Yeah.
And I didn't turn my attention to actually looking after that, and I should have done.
Keep
that's
the list
exactly,
and do it. Yeah.
That's exactly what John Lennon meant.
I stood in that doorway in Hamburg where the famous photo was taken of John in 1961 that became the cover of the
His
rock
black
and roll album.
On. Yeah.
And I struck that pose, and there's a picture of me standing exactly like him in that doorway.
Brilliant.
And I rediscovered that album, and actually for me, that is the real John.
Yeah.
All those covers that he did on that LP... Yeah. For me, that was the honest John, and the one he moved right away from when he became a Beatle.
Stand By Me is my favourite track on that LP.
Yeah.
Right, OK, Leslie Anna, when's this book out?
It'll be October 2020.
To commemorate 40 years of John Lennon's death and 80 years of John Lennon's life.
They are.
Fantastic. Leslie Anna, thank you very much indeed. And you have been listening to Life on Planet Porky. Don't go anywhere, folks. There'll be another one along very soon. People at that age, if they think, oh, I'm going to make myself famous, walk to the South Pole, why don't you make yourself credible and get a fucking job? Because while you're walking to the South Pole, mate, a lot of your friends are actually getting jobs and working and will be a lot further up the old greasy pole of life before you get out there.
That is not contributing to the economy or to the world.
No. In any way.
Get a job.
In any way. They freeze to death at the top waiting to get to the summit. They literally freeze to death.
Yeah.
It's minus 25, and so they're, you know, supposed to clap their hands and stamp their feet and all that. And then older people just either fall off the mountain because they get frozen stiff, or they die of hypothermia.
That's what they get for dropping banana skins.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I've got no sympathy.
Good. The Amish were made famous in which film? Was it called The Amish? Yeah, I think it was called The Amish. It involved the guy who was also... what's his name? You know, the guy with the whip, you know? You know, the guy in the...
I've known a few guys with whips.
No, oh, really? Well, you don't know about this. It's a family show. I want the streets to be quieter on a Sunday.
I
want to be able...
You want to pound the pavements, don't you?
If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.